from the studio of Tulsa On Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Investing in early childhood brings a healthy return on investment. It's said that for every $1 society spends supporting children from the ages of 0 to 3, we get a $7 return in future costs avoided in areas like healthcare or the legal system. Oklahoma is one of the few states that funds universal pre-kindergarten, and here in Tulsa, we're lucky to have great investments in early childhood through programs like the Community Action Project and our three Educare centers. But are there ways to improve health outcomes that don't involve hard dollars? It may surprise you, but the simple act of talking to your child gets them ready to read and participate in school. This may be something you take for granted, but my guest today does not. Dr. Dana Suskind is an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and director of the Pediatric Cochlear Implant Program at the University of Chicago. Through her work providing hearing to kids that are born deaf, she made the observation that some of the kids given hearing for the first time quickly get up to age level, while others lag behind, in some cases permanently. Ever curious, she delved into the research on the subject and found that children not exposed to a word-rich environment enter school having heard 30 million fewer words than their peers. Inspired to do something about it, Suskind founded the 30 Million Words Initiative, which seeks to address this imbalance by educating the public about the importance of reading and talking to children, which applies as much to kids with normal hearing as it does to those who receive cochlear implants. Suskind worked with a multidisciplinary research and advocacy team to spread the word about her initiative, even going so far as bringing the message to the White House. She has a brand new book out called 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain, just out from Dutton. Dr. Dana Suskind is my guest today on Studio Tulsa On Health. You're an ear, nose, and throat surgeon at the University of Chicago, and your expertise is in placing cochlear implants. And so I was wondering if we could start by you telling us, what is a cochlear implant and how does it work?
First of all, thank you so much for having me. A cochlear implant is actually really an amazing piece of technology that allows a child born deaf or even an adult who goes deaf to restore hearing, the ability not just to hear, but to learn how to talk and really to learn on par with their hearing peers. So it has dramatically changed what a child born deaf can expect out of life.
Tell us a little more how it works. Like, you're implanting an electrode, so to speak, in the acoustic nerve?
Yeah, so your hearing, the nerve part of your hearing starts in a place in your ear called the cochlea. It's like this little snail-shaped structure, probably the size of a pea. And it's the beginning of where the nerve part of hearing starts. And that nerve part of hearing goes all the way up to the brain. You know, what's really important to know is hearing sounds like it's the ear, but really it's the brain that hears. The ear just sort of transmits the sound. And for most children who are born deaf, it's not actually the big nerve that connects up to the brain. It's really the beginning parts of the nerve in the cochlea that don't work. And so what I do when I place this cochlear implant device into the ear is I put this little electrode into the cochlea, and it, you know, snakes around the little snail-shaped cochlea, and it bypasses the defective part of the hearing part of the ear, and it stimulates the nerve directly. So all of a sudden, you know, children who could expect, you know, basically to be profoundly deaf their entire lives can hear almost at, you know, at normal levels. Some of my implant patients probably hear better than myself. And what's amazing is that it allows, you know, as I mentioned, people think about hearing as the ear, but it's really the brain. And what cochlear implantation has allowed children to do is to hear during that critical period when your brain is learning language. None of us actually remember learning our native tongue because it happens so easily in the first 3 years of life. You know, the words just go into our ears, up into our brain, and our brains make sense of it. And what the implant does is it allows these kids to hear early during this critical period so they can develop spoken language.
So that raises the question of, and you write about this beautifully, what, you know, when you have a kid who has been born deaf and you put in this cochlear implant and suddenly they're essentially given the miracle or the gift of hearing, but it's not so easy. It's not just like you snap your fingers, now they can hear, and suddenly they can talk. I mean, you point out that the earlier you do this, it seems the better it is because they still have to learn the language, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it was actually that experience which really sort of changed my whole journey as a physician and as a researcher. Because as I talk about in the book, I started implanting, you know, wonderful children with wonderful families from all different backgrounds who had been born deaf. And most babies born deaf are born to hearing parents who only know how to use spoken language, not sign. And they would come to me for a cochlear implant so that their children could hear. And I started implanting these children. And pretty soon after implanting them, I started noticing huge differences in their outcomes, in terms of hearing and talking and reading. And that difference almost always fell along socioeconomic lines. And it was really that difference in seeing these inequities, if you will, that really pushed me to question, you know, why was this? I mean, these kids all had tremendous potential to learn how to talk. Why was it that I was seeing these differences? And it's what really, you know, pushed me into the sciences. And, you know, the University of Chicago has some incredible scientists who really opened my eyes to the fact that what I was seeing in these children and these differences had nothing to do with their hearing loss, but rather the world in which they had been born. And for children who had been born into homes with less rich language, that was the big differential. Because even though, you know, we think of cochlear implants as the greatest miracle, and they really are incredible, it's really just, you know, the switch that allows the sound to get to the brain. But if you are born into a home where there's not a whole lot of language to bathe, you know, your brain in language so you can understand what those sounds mean, it's rather meaningless. And that was it was an eye-opening experience for me. The book and my program, it's named after actually a very famous study done 30 years ago by researchers Betty Hart and Todd Risley. And I can tell you about the study in a little bit, but basically what they found was that in the first 3 years of life, there are some children, especially from low socioeconomic backgrounds, who by the end of the age of three will have heard 30 million fewer words than their more affluent peers. And just that difference in hearing, the difference in language, predicted not just differences in vocabulary. I mean, it predicted differences in the third grade of IQ and test scores. So you can see the profound impact that language had on kids with typical hearing. So you take that to my patient population who have been born deaf and now could hear. If you're not hearing the language, those important connections in the brain aren't going to happen.
So I do want to come back to that, but first tell us, you have a couple of case studies that you write about, Zach and Michelle. So these are kids of about similar age, and they had totally different outcomes. So what were the stories of Zach and Michelle?
I always joke as a surgeon, you know, when you start an implant program, you're like, okay, I'm ready, you know, I want it to be very busy. But I think I really benefited from the fact that, you know, things started out slowly in the implant program. So I was able to really get to know my patients and their families, and I still do, but, you know, really in a very deep and nuanced way, sort of the way we watch our own children develop. And Zach and Michelle were two of my first few children that I took care of with their families. And they both came to me with equal potentials. They had been both diagnosed deaf at birth, and they were both born to hearing parents who loved them very much. But, you know, Zach came from a family who, I won't say affluent, but they were middle to higher socioeconomic status, you know, whose parents said, you know, we want them, our baby, to learn how to listen and talk. And in the same way, Michelle, who was born into a lower socioeconomic status family with a mother who loved her deeply, also wanted her to talk. And so they both received implantation fairly early on. Zach got his first implant, I remember it well, on his birthday, actually at 12 months. And he was this little peanut of a guy with, really light hair and light eyes. And he underwent implantation. Everything went well. And pretty early on, I can tell you some funny stories. We implanted him. He had a chatty older sister and a mother who talked a lot. And, you know, you saw him just blossom. He started understanding words, you know, on the normal trajectory. And, you know, when I was writing the book, he was actually in third grade reading and doing math at age level. I mean, which is profound for a child born deaf, right? In contrast, Michelle, who was literally one of the most gorgeous children I've ever seen. She has something called Wardenburg syndrome, which is a syndrome where you have normal intelligence. And it turns out I actually have a cousin, a distant cousin with it as well. She was born with the most remarkable eyes. They were blue as well. But unlike Zach, they were like, they look like sapphires. If you ever look up Wardenburg syndrome in the pictures, you can see like literally sapphire blue eyes. And she was just a bright, beautiful little girl. And she went underwent implantation a little bit later, but still, you know, fairly young, under two. But unlike Zach, her progression was incredibly slow, and it made us, you know, very nervous. We were very much involved with her mom and really giving support. And her mom was wonderful, but had a huge, you know, the stresses of poverty, you know, to say being poor is difficult would probably be the greatest of understatements, and had significant stressors in her life. They moved away and came back. Long and short of it, you know, she really never really did develop spoken language or sign language. I want to point out that I am very much supportive of parents who want to use sign with their children. I think language is language. But so she really never developed either, you know, in great depth. And, you know, when I was writing this book, she too was in third grade. And I actually saw her when she was in first, you know, in the public school system in a deaf classroom, you know, really with, you know, very little language. And it was incredibly painful to watch, because this little girl was born with all the potential in the world. And to see it wasted, you know, broke my heart. And really, she inspired me to push forward so that, you know, we can figure out ways that all children are able to reach the potentials that they're meant to reach.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher today. My guest is Dana Suskin, who's a professor of surgery at the University of Chicago and founder of the 30 Million Words Initiative. She has a new book out called 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain. And Dana Suskin, you mentioned the work of Todd Risley and Betty Hart. They did research that showed essentially this 30 million word gap in by age three that kids in, I guess you could say, word-deprived environments heard that many fewer. So how did you come up with the idea for the 30 million words initiative, and what is it?
I was definitely inspired by Betty Hart and Todd Risley's study, but I want to also say that there's really a first sentence in a robust literature showing the impact of language on brain development. And really, while you can focus on, you know, this 30 million word gap, I actually prefer to look at it as incredible potential, incredible power that parents hold, that so many parents don't realize that they have. And we spend a huge amount of our time and effort in really translating the science so that all parents can understand, you know, how incredibly powerful they are. Understanding the science inspired me, and we found that it inspires, you know, many families. Really sharing, you know, strategies, it's, you know, for building their children's brain. I do want to make a caveat that, you know, while our program is about developing science-based programs for families, from, you know, the newborn hospital to the pediatrician's offices to home visits to, you know, museums, to help families really understand their power, this program nor my philosophy is just about, oh, go talk to your kids and that's going to fix everything. It's really also a statement to the fact that we have to support parents and invest in parents so that they can invest in their children. No one is going to have the bandwidth, the energy to talk, you know, unless you have stable health, you know, home life, childcare. All of these things are important components to allowing parents to be their children's first and most important teachers.
Okay, so ideal scenario, you have a stable home life. What do we want parents to know about 30 million words? What should they, how should we optimally be parenting our children so they are bathed in language?
Absolutely. Well, we've really culled it down to something that we call the three T's. Because you say, well, you know, how do you do this? So the three T's for us are the core. It's tune in, talk more, and take turns. And what is tune in? Tune in is really, you know, following your child's lead, connecting to what they're interested in, getting them excited about what you're interested in, Because we all know that if, you know, you're talking about the baseball scores or, you know, what's going on outside and your baby or your child is focused on the blocks, all that rich language is just going to go right over his head. So you've got, or her head. So you really have to be focused on what they're focused on. Then talk more is just as it sounds. Really talking more, using rich descriptive language, decontextualized language, which is really talking about the past and the future. And then lastly is take turns. It's really, I think it's almost the most important T. It's really viewing your child as a conversational partner from day one. I think so many parents don't realize that even before a child has its first word or first even babble, they are getting ready to talk and have a conversation. So it's so important to, you know, respond to every, you know, gesture or glance or grimace or burp, because they are getting ready to talk. And by using these three T's, it's sort of a metric or a measuring stick that parents can optimize every interaction, whether they're changing their child's diaper or walking them to the bus stop. The three T's for us are the core.
So talking really is teaching. And the thing is that what you point out in the book is that, you know, this is essentially free. I mean, this is an abundant resource that's there that we're not taking advantage of.
Yeah. I say it's the most unrecognized resource and really the most powerful resource in our world. I mean, if you think about, you know, how we think and, you know, our brains, really that's the foundation of all civilizations, right? And if it's language that builds it, well, then it's the most important resource. And here it's free. I just want everybody to know it, especially with all this technology that we have going on these days. So
you taught us about the three T's, and I wonder, is it really that simple? Could we change the culture just by getting parents? And I do want to emphasize that the talking back, letting the kid verbalize and talk, is really important for completing the neural circuit, right? So they hear things, they're learning the language, but unless they have a chance to express themselves, they haven't necessarily been able to replicate or complete the circuit as well. So what are the obstacles, I guess? How can we make this more a matter of, I don't want to say policy and make it sound staid and boring, but how do we make it a part of our culture?
You know, I think it's about getting this message out. You know, nobody questions the fact that we put our babies on their back to sleep or we put on a seatbelt. Now, granted, those are single motions, or that smoking is not good. It's really about getting this idea into the groundwater and then supporting families in their ability to do that. It's also understanding that learning starts, you know, at day one, not the first day of school, which, you know, I'm not a big policy person, but really it's just a huge disconnect. I mean, John, you're a physician too. Could you imagine having a children's hospital that only started at 3, you know, when preschool started? No, we know health starts from day one. And so why is the educational landscape saying, okay, really education starts at 3? That's when we're really going to focus on it. Because we know it starts from day one. So we really need to think about our approaches. Now, it's hard, right? Because it's talking about parents and families. But you can't deny the science, the brain science, that shows that this is the foundation for all thinking and learning. So we need to figure out how to approach it in that way.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher today. My guest is Dana Suskin. She's a professor of surgery at the University of Chicago and founder of the 30 Million Words Initiative. Her new book is 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain. Dana, you're lucky because there at University of Chicago, you literally just have to walk across a street or two, and you can walk into the office of a Nobel Prize winner, or several Nobel Prize winners, and one that you have had a lot of contact with is a guy named Jim Heckman, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics. What did his work show that got him interested in your work?
Yeah, so Professor Heckman is he's an economist, but I've heard that people say that he is the greatest living social scientist. I mean, he's quite amazing. And what he's really showed is that investment in the early childhood time period has a huge return on investment. The problem with early childhood is, you know, they look like cute little babies, you know. It almost looks like glorified daycare. And it's hard for people to understand why it's so important to invest in that period, right, if it looks like daycare. But what Professor Heckman showed was that, you know, for every dollar invested in this time period, society saves like $7 a year, $7 plus dollars per annum. So it's a great return on investment. And let's face it, in this time in our country and in this world, we need, people want to know that it's a smart investment. We want it to be a moral investment, but it's also a smart investment. And so he's been, obviously a great inspiration to me, was kind enough to, read the book and support it. But I do want to say, the University of Chicago is a really cool place. I always joke that I think that a surgeon wouldn't, at any other place, would have just been sort of like, shut down, go back to the operating room. Don't think about this world. That's not your area. And really, I've been supported in the greatest ways by really incredibly smart, humane individuals who fostered my journey as well. So I'm very thankful for that.
Dana, I wanted to go back a little bit in your personal history. So you were a surgeon, but you write in the book that initially you thought about brain surgery, about neurosurgery. So I guess you had a sort of an adverse experience when you were at first sort of scrubbed into brain surgery, but you can talk about that. But amazingly, you became an otolaryngologist, an ear, nose, and throat surgeon, and yet your work with cochlear implants has brought you back well into the fold of brain science and neural development and this 0 to 3. I mean, you've in a way gone, well beyond perhaps what you originally envisioned. So what happened to you in your early neurosurgery days?
I've always been just completely enamored by the brain. I mean, it's who we are. It's who we are as a civilization. And so a story in the book that you are alluding to embarrassingly is when I was working with a neurosurgeon in my medical school, and we were writing papers together and writing a chapter, and we were writing a chapter on meningiomas, which are a benign brain tumor. And he said, Dana, why don't you come into the operating room and see me operate? And of course, I was incredibly excited. I was going to see the brain. And, I think I was almost like a starstruck girl when, you meet this celebrity. But instead, the celebrity for me was the brain. The brain was like the epicenter of who we were or who we are. And I walked into that operating room very excited. And, I think I described, here, I won't go into graphic detail, but the brain was exposed. And, for me, all of a sudden, it was like, whoa, this is who we are. And it's like this big blob of gelatinous tissue. And it was just, quite overwhelming that I described. I did not fully faint. Okay, John, I really didn't. But I actually became fairly lightheaded and had to sort of sit down. It didn't happen again. And when I operate, I no longer have any of those events. But I just remember just being so overwhelmed with, this is really, it's our last frontier, the brain. And so, as I ended up deciding to go into otolaryngology, which is ear, nose, and throat surgery, for a multitude of reasons. But I think what's interesting is that, going back to cochlear implantation, really, it's almost like going back to the brain. I always say hearing's not the ear, it's the brain. And in some ways, the cochlear implant is one of the greatest neurologic miracles of all time, because here a child born deaf who would never be able to hear and really usually not be able to use spoken language, although there's, you can discuss that, all of a sudden could do all of those things. And so, as a surgeon, it brought me full circle. And then now my work as, in the 30 Million Words Initiative has in some ways brought me full circle, because these programs that we work with families and their children, in a way, it's neuroscience in the dark. I'm not able to, see their brain, brains lighting up in these kids, but I know that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to maximize their, allow them to reach their potentials.
So I wanted to ask you, introduce a concept, and I asked earlier about how we make this change of, building a child's brain, tune in, talk more, and take turns, your three T's. How do we make that policy, or how do we embed that in the culture? And as you, I think, referenced, we need to put it in the water. So you talk about an approach called the dual generation approach late in the book as a possible way in which, as a model, I guess you could say, for how we have done this to some extent and how we can broaden this. Can you comment about that a little bit?
Absolutely. I always say when we advocate for the power of parent talk, we also it also means that we have to advocate for the parent, right? Because they're the ultimate architects of their children's brains. And so there is something called the dual generation approach, which actually, believe it or not, Tulsa is a leader. Stephen Dow at CAP is an amazing guy. And it's really what it does is it works to invest in parents, both educationally, as individuals and as parents, to help really sort of not just fortify, but really support them as individuals and as parents. And I think that it's a really important way to approach this issue because, you know, ultimately the science is clear. Unless children, you know, receive this rich language environment from nurturing caregivers, empowered caregivers, you know, we're going to have a hard time closing this gap. And what the dual generation approach does is invest in parents in the way they should be invested in. You know, I do want to say that, you know, like, you know, as I was talking to Stephen, we need science to be part of this. It doesn't mean, because we know this is the right way, it doesn't mean we know exactly the way it should be approached. And that's why I believe science, you know, I always say good science can be the basis for real social change. We need to be systematic in the development of these social programs to understand what works and what doesn't work. Because just because we understand that language is what builds a child's brain doesn't mean we know exactly what the program should look like. And that's why science is so key. I'm not sure if that made sense.
No, that's good. And I should just clarify that CAP stands for the Community Action Project, which is the program that Stephen Dow runs here in Tulsa. And just wanted to, I guess, finish by saying that, you know, the 30 Million Words Initiative has received quite some recognition. And you've brought the program, as it were, or been highlighted all the way to the White House.
Yeah, no, I feel very, I mean, you know, I always say that this is just an idea whose time has come. You know, I am one of many messengers, you know, trying to spread the idea that the power of parent talk is really at the core of children's brain development. So I feel incredibly honored to be, you know, on this journey. But really, the people that, you know, should be touted are these incredible parents. You know, mothers and fathers that we've worked with on the south side of Chicago, what they do every day in and day out, you know, with the incredible hardships that they face just is inspiring. And I do want to say one thing since I'm talking to the Tulsa affiliate, that really Tulsa should be so proud because you are a leader in this early childhood landscape and understanding, you know, the approaches that we need to do to support children and their families. And you're systematic and you're humane and, you know, I'm excited one day to, actually, I'm going to be visiting Tulsa, I think, sometime in October, but you're a leader in this country.
Well, we look forward to your visit here and congratulations on the book, the publication of the book, 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain. The author is Dana Suskin, who's a professor of surgery at the University of Chicago and has founded the 30 Million Words Initiative. Thank you so much for appearing on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Dana Suskin is an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and director of the Pediatric Cochlear Implant Program at the University of Chicago. Her new book is 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain, just out from Dutton. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed by our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you want to listen anytime to one of our programs, you can stream them online by going to our website, studiotulsa.org. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.